This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Fracking is a form of natural gas drilling, an alternative to oil, because the oil kept spilling, bringing jobs to small towns, so everybody's willing. People turn on the lights and the drillers make a killing.
Water goes into the pipe into the ground. The pressure cranes finishes 7,000 feet down. The cracks release the gas that powers your town. That well's fracked, yeah, totally fracked.
My water's on fire tonight, from the Australian album Whole Lot of Frackin' Goin' On. Pollution of wells and whole drinking water aquifers are just part of the risk of shale gas fracking. For years, governments, industry, and TV ads told us natural gas is the safe bridge fuel while we move away from dirty coal and oil. Cornell University scientist Robert Howarth wondered, is that true? When Howarth found no science to back up the big claims for the gas industry, he and a team from Cornell went to work. The results are startling. In the short term, escaped methane from gas fracking threatened to tip us into catastrophic climate change. The total impact of the shale gas industry may be worse than coal. In the United States, where thousands and thousands of new gas wells are drilled, almost half of all greenhouse gas emissions may come from the gas industry alone. The United Kingdom may be next. With gas production from the North Sea fields down by 25%, there is a public relations push to get lots of gas fracking in the UK. This may be the next big environmental battle there. Fracking mania has hit Canada and Australia as well. Everyone needs to know what the latest science says. The shocking results from this peer-reviewed paper, published in the journal Climatic Change Letters, set off a firestorm of criticism, especially from the shale gas industry. Robert Howarth defends the paper, Methane and Greenhouse Gas Footprint of Natural Gas from Shale Formations. It was co-authored with engineering professor Tony Ingrafia and René Santoro, a research technician, both of the prestigious Cornell University in New York State. I'm going to play you a recording of a speech by Robert Howarth, November 3, 2011, at the annual conference of the Association for the Study of Peak Oil and Gas, USA, in Washington, D.C. The recording is by Carl Etnier from Equal Time Radio, WDEV-FM, Waterbury, Vermont. Following this powerful speech, I will do a follow-up interview with Robert Howarth. He explains a slide from the speech, his reasons for doing the study, new science on methane, and his claims fracked gas is worse than coal. Then we'll squeeze in an interview promised last week with Samuel Labuddy about the billion-dollar scam ripping off carbon credits. Companies in China are threatened to release powerful greenhouse gases unless these fake credits are continued. Ratepayers in Europe are being blackmailed. Stay tuned for that hot story. But first, here is Cornell scientist and professor of ecology and biology, Robert Howarth, at the Washington ASPO USA conference, introduced by board member Art Berman.
Bob Howarth is the David R. Atkinson Professor of Ecology and Environmental Biology at Cornell University, and he and Tony have published several papers together on this and other topics.
Thank you, Art, and thank you to the organizers for inviting me to this. I also have about 20 minutes, and I want to spend it going to more detail on this question of the greenhouse gas emissions. Let me jump right into the story. I want to put it in the context of climate change and how to think about climate change, and I want to emphasize a few times through the talk that I and many other Earth system scientists are very concerned about the fairly near-term consequences of global warming, what might happen over the next 20, 30, 50 years sort of time periods. The reason for that is in part the nature of the climate change system, and this is a cool little figure that came out earlier this year, sort of a survey of how Americans think about it. And a lot of Americans think that the climate change is very stable, that lower left-hand corner there, things just roll along. Some people think that the climate is very unstable, always ready to just fall apart. The reality, of course, is what 34%, surprisingly large percentage of adult Americans believe, that the climate change is in a relatively stable hole. It takes some effort to disturb it and move it out of that hole, but we can. And the point is that the potential to move it into an alternate behavioral system is real. It's happened multiple times in the history of the Earth before. And there are a variety of tipping points which could happen. And there's reasons to think that many of those we could approach over the next century. Some of them we might approach over the next few decades. So clearly we don't want to move the climate change into a radically different environment. Slow warming is bad enough, but moving into a radically different climate system would be a much, much scarier possibility. Just want to hit on an example or two of the sort of tipping points which might happen. One of these we're starting to see already. The incidence of fires in tundra systems has gone up remarkably over the last decade, and that's because these systems, which did not have lightning storms for most of the past millennia, are getting a huge increase in lightning strikes because they're getting more cumulative weather in the Arctic, and that sets off fires, things burn, and you get some positive feedbacks from carbon dioxide release and change in albedo, et cetera. Another one that's quite scary is the possibility of melting permafrost and freeing up methane clathrates and methane hydrates, and thereby putting natural sources of methane very rapidly into the atmosphere at unprecedented rates. That's a very scary possibility, and I want to come back to that a little bit later on in my talk. Because of this concern, this umbrella group, the Council of Scientific Society Presidents, it's a group that represents collectively about 1.5 million U.S. scientists in 150 different disciplines. And the group, a year and a half ago, wrote a letter to Obama saying, you know, climate change is real. Your administration has to take it much more seriously. Secretary Chu had said that society needs to treat this as an emergency and put all of our resources behind it. He said that. We bought into that and told the president he should support Chu and move it forward. That quote at the bottom there, the necessary transition will require nothing short of a new industrial revolution, that's Secretary Chu's statement. I agree with that. The Council of Scientific Society of Presidents agreed to that. We urged the president to do that. And in this letter, we also pointed out that some solutions, in quotes, for global warming might not be solutions. We used two examples. One was corn ethanol. Might not be such a good idea for climate warming. Good politics, but not good for climate warming. And we also said shale gas might not be the panacea that people perceive. At the time we wrote this, there wasn't a huge amount of science behind that, but that was part of the point. We pointed out that the government was moving ahead on a policy based on precious little science. So what is the science? What is the role of shale gas in the context of global warming? And shale gas, as I'm sure you know, is widely promoted as this bridge fuel that allows society to replace oil, replace coal, continue to have a fossil fuel existence, and yet put out fewer greenhouse gas emissions than these other fossil fuels, so move us towards a climate future that might make sense. The question is that true? And that's what I'll spend my next 16 minutes on. Tony Ingraffia and Rene Santoro and I put out a paper on this subject in the Climatic Change Letters, peer-reviewed paper, last April. This is the very first comprehensive study on this topic, whether in the peer-reviewed literature or not. So when you've heard before that, yeah, this is a great fuel, its greenhouse gas emissions are low, that's not based on anything out there in the literature to speak of. I'm going to run quickly through some of our work, and then I'm going to tell you what's been happening since our paper came out. It's only 6 months ago, but lots been happening. And this leads into the way I want you to think about it. This leads into the figure which Tony already showed you, sort of a summary figure we reprinted in Nature 7 weeks ago. So on the left there, the blue bars here are the direct emissions of carbon dioxide per energy produced, grams carbon as carbon dioxide per megajoule of energy released as heat energy when a fuel is burnt. And the first two bars on the left are shale gas. I'll come back to why we have two in a minute. Next to our conventional natural gas, then we have two bars for coal, one for surface mine coal and one for deep coal and one for diesel oil. And yes, indeed, the amount of carbon dioxide that's released to get a unit of energy from natural gas, whether shale gas or conventional gas, is far lower than that of coal or diesel. So in that sense, it's true. It's a clean fuel. The red bars there are the indirect emissions of carbon dioxide. We did a tedious little accounting exercise looking at the trucking of the water, the drilling of the pumps, the running of compressors, you name it. And those are our estimates of how much carbon dioxide is released in that. It's not trivial, but nor is it particularly exciting to look at. Rene Santoro, who's our co-author and worked on this, if I asked her to do something like this again, she'd probably quit in a minute. But anyway, very tedious. Methane is the story, and methane is what I want to concentrate on. Of course, natural gas is mostly methane, more than 90%. Methane is the second most important greenhouse gas and global warming, and exactly how much important it is compared to carbon dioxide is a function of your time scale of interest. I'll come back and say a little bit more about that. But Jim Hansen, whom I respect highly, has said that methane is responsible for 50% as much global warming as carbon dioxide at the moment. Okay, Tony showed you a video behind this. What I'm going to show you here is a built-up table. We're going to compare methane leakage from conventional gas and from shale gas at a series of steps. It's basically a life cycle analysis from the wellhead all the way through delivery of natural gas to final consumer. I'm going to go through this in a series of steps and add it in. So the first thing here is the initial completion. Right after we put that hydraulic fluids into the ground and do the fracturing, there's a flowback period. Tony said this. Usually lasts about 2 weeks, give or take a few days, before the well is brought online and connected to a pipeline. There's no equivalent to that for conventional gas and not much methane leakage in this two-week period, is what we're talking about. But we estimate that about 1.9% of the lifetime production of a shale gas well flows to the atmosphere in that sort of venting that Tony demonstrated at this point. Now, this is based on 5 studies, all unpublished, all industry sources. Most of them are from EPA PowerPoint presentations. Some are from other unpublished reports. Quality of data is not good, but I'll come back with why I think it's believable in a minute. It's the best data that are out there as well. The rest of the comparisons I'm going to give you here, the other sources of methane, are the same for conventional gas and for shale gas, so keep that in mind. The next two here are the after the well is finished and goes online over the lifetime of the well, about 7 years, we think, in the case of a shale gas well, longer for a conventional gas well. There is routine leaking and emissions at the well site. We used a study from the General Accountability Office that came out 16 months ago for that. Those are the numbers there. There's also this thing called liquid unloading. A fluid builds up in a well. The industry has to get the fluid out of there to increase the productivity of the well, and they vent methane when they do that. That number also is from the General Accountability Office. So you sum those up, and you have a comparison of sort of the wellhead processes for leakage from conventional gas versus shale gas. There's more from shale gas because of this initial venting. We've gotten a huge amount of feedback, both positive and negative, on the paper since it came out 6 months ago. Huge amount of stuff in the blogosphere and some stuff in the peer-reviewed literature I'll get to in a minute. But one of the criticisms is that we just can't be right on the initial shale gas number. It doesn't agree at all with what the Environmental Protection Agency says. So I want to point out here that actually our number is dead on with what the Environmental Protection Agency says. Their latest greenhouse gas inventories, which was done after our paper and partially in response to our paper, says that up to this stage, 3.4% of the lifetime production of a gas well comes out as methane, right in our mid-range. Gas sometimes has to be processed to get rid of sulfides or some other hydrocarbons. We used information from the American Petroleum Institute for that. And as I say here, this gets you up to sort of to storage and long-range transmission distribution storage part of gas. So this is only part of the comparison of the total emissions to the atmosphere associated with gas use. And the rest would be storage and transmission and distribution. And I want to admit right up front that there are not really good data on what the emissions are here. But there's a lot of purposeful venting that's associated with storage as well in order to keep pressures under control. And there are leaks from pipelines. The average long-distance transmission pipeline in the United States is more than 50 years old. They leak. We get big accidents. Rob and I were part of a workshop in Boston a few weeks ago where there are all sorts of industry experts talking about this, and there are huge numbers of routine leaks, which industry just doesn't find it cost-effective to capture. This is in the high-pressure transmission lines. Local distribution systems within cities are probably worse. I'll take the city of Philadelphia for an example. The system was laid down 85 years ago. For the most part, it's cast iron pipes that are not welded together. They're stuck end-to-end. They had a sealant in them, which probably disappeared back in the 1920s or 1930s. They have not been repaired. And the city, by looking at what they put into the system versus what comes out, estimate that they lose about 3% of what they put in just within their city system. So leaky systems. So we came up with an estimate of 1.4 to 3.6% loss during that part of the process, and I really don't want to spend much time defending that at the moment. I'm happy to later. It's not a very good number. The data behind it aren't very good, but I actually think it's conservative, which gives us those sort of ranges for the total loss from shale gas and conventional gas wellhead to consumer. Now, how do we put that in context with carbon dioxide in terms to get to the overall greenhouse gas footprint of the technology? And the way we do that is by what's called a global warming potential. It's how much more effective methane is as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. And it is a function of the time of interest of study. So in this figure, which Tony's already showed, this is from Nature. They glossed it up over what we published originally, but it's from our April paper. This is the 20-year integrated analysis of how methane looks. So the upper bars there are the methane. The one on the left, the first two, are the low estimate and high estimate for shale gas methane, then the same for conventional gas, then surface and deep mine coal, and for diesel. So there's methane loss from all of those, but it's much larger in the natural gas industry. And at this time scale, using the global warming potential we did, and I'll come back to that in a second, this fuel actually has a greenhouse gas footprint that is far worse than the other fossil fuels I'm showing you there. Top figure here is the same as that of our real paper, not glossed up by Nature. So again, at this 20-year integrated time frame, the greenhouse gas footprint is quite large for methane. Methane has a residence time in the atmosphere of about a decade compared to about a century for carbon dioxide. So as you look into longer time frames, the influence of methane is diminished, and that's shown in the lower figure, 100-year integrated time frame after emission. And here, the shale gas is, depending on whether you want to look at our low or high estimate, it roughly is in the range of what fuels like coal are. It's not particularly better, not particularly worse. Now, again, I want to emphasize, we showed both the short and long time frame in our paper because both are important. They're important for different reasons. But I'm particularly concerned about the short time frame, and I want to explain to you why. When we sent our paper out for review, they suggested that we leave out the 100-year time frame, we concentrate on the short, because all climate change scientists know we need to concentrate in that short time frame. We didn't. We included both, and we've been blasted in the blogosphere for even thinking of including the short time frame. You should only include the long time frame. I'm concerned about the short time frame. Why? This figure, how many of you have seen this figure? It's from a new report UNEP and World Meteorological Organization put out just this past summer. And what it shows is the Earth's average temperature there up until 2009. That's the squiggly line. And then some projections of where we might go into the future. And what's called the reference line there is the IPCC sort of status quo scenario of what will happen if society continues to plug away more or less as we are. And you'll see we get into that yellow, which is a worrisome area of global warming, where UNEP and the World Meteorological Organization think we may well start to encounter some tipping points. We get there pretty soon, and then we get up into that orange pretty soon, not that many years out. The other figures on there are what we might do about it. The first line down is CO2 measures. That's as if we were to, as a world, take on aggressive carbon dioxide controls now, immediately. There'd be a delay in seeing an influence on temperature, but over the next several years, say by 2040, we'd start to see some influence of that and some curving off, but we'd still be seeing dangerous tipping points. The lowest line down there, which says CO2 and methane and BC, that stands for black carbon measurements, that is if we took aggressive efforts to control CO2, methane, and black carbon now. And that gives us some hope of keeping the climate where we might want it to be. The one just above that, the blue line, which looks about the same for until 2040 and then starts to go up, that's as if we controlled methane and black carbon alone and not CO2.
This is Radio EcoShock. You are listening to Cornell University Professor Robert Howarth on shale gas fracking and climate change. This speech was November 3rd at the ASPO USA Peak Oil and Gas Conference in Washington, D.C. Here again is Robert Howarth.
The point is that we're better off if we're worried about short-term climate to control methane than anything else, and we need to control methane, and we need to do so in that time frame if we want to avoid these tipping points. If you have any doubt about that, I'd commend this paper to you by Hansen et al. Came out 4 years ago, Climate Change and Trace Gases. It highlights the need to control methane. And he says strongly that we need to control methane as well as carbon dioxide, and we need to be doing so from now if we want to avoid dangerous tipping points. And he particularly leads out the 1.8 degrees from the background temperature change as a tipping point where he believes we might run into melting of permafrost, methane clathrates, methane hydrates, and get into a runaway positive feedback of methane from natural sources. Where does that put on here? The red line is that 1.8 degrees. Status quo will get there in about 2030, 20 years from now. And the only way, according to this UNEP WMO assessment, that we're going to avoid that is to put on aggressive controls for methane and black carbon now. Okay, our paper came out in April. It was really the first study that looked comprehensively at this, certainly the first one to include methane at all. Since then, there's been a host of papers. I'm going to run through them here. There's one more. If you really follow us closely, you might ask me later. It's a paper by Hultman and all that came out last week that I haven't had time to put on here, but it basically tracks the Scone paper there. You can keep it in mind. Scone is a surrogate for Hultman if you want to think about it. I want to tell you what these papers say. Some of them basically say we're right. Some of them say we're wrong. More of these say we're wrong than right. I want to show you what's driving that conclusion. So here I'm comparing some of the major assumptions behind our study and behind the other studies, which, again, have all come out since April. And I'll go through this. It says draft. Please do not quote, because we're hoping to get a paper out on this, which we'll be submitting in about 2 to 3 weeks. And there's a pretty good chance some of these numbers will change by 4 or 5%, and I'd rather not be nitpicked on that sort of small change. But the picture is pretty robust, and these will be ready to be quoted within the month if people are interested. So first, the time scale. Again, we looked at the 20 and 100-year studies. So did David Hughes in a study that came out shortly after ours. The next three papers down only looked at the 100 years. They said there's no value to looking at the short time frame. The paper at the bottom was one by Tom Wigley, and he looked at it continuously. He didn't use this global warming potential idea because he thinks it's too simplistic. He used a more sophisticated atmospheric chemistry model. He looked continuously over a 200-year time frame, but it certainly includes a shorter time frame. The next factor over there is the global warming potential. We used 105 for the 20-year time period and 33 for the 20-year time period, as did Hughes. Again, Wigley didn't use this because he didn't use that approach, but the other three studies here all used 25. Now, why do we use a higher number than they use? Because there's a paper that came out by Drew Schindel in 2009 in Science explaining that methane has a higher global warming potential than the IPCC had previously believed. And for context, Drew Schindel is now the lead author on the next IPCC assessment on this. So the next IPCC assessment is very likely to say that. But the other papers said, no, we shouldn't have done that. We should have used the old IPCC assessment that predates the newer science. The next here is the methane leakage. It's the grams methane as carbon per megajoule of energy released in heat energy. Our numbers work out to a range of 0.56 to 1.3. David Hughes used our numbers in the analysis. The next three studies all end up around 0.34 or so. Wigley didn't make an assumption. He tested a range of assumptions. And I want to point out that the EPA new official numbers, which have come out since our paper was done, are slightly lower than ours. They're between 0.49 to 0.78, but they overlap and they're in the range of ours, and they're well above the other papers which have come out in between. And of course, if you want to compare with coal, you need to look at the methane leakage from coal. Those are our numbers. They're right on with the EPA. We actually go much higher on the surface, on the deep mine coal, but we're right on with the EPA for surface coal. And the other studies, particularly Scone and this Leedis-Hutland paper, have methane from coal that are based on 35-year-old literature and are patently wrong. So where does that leave you? The red papers here are the ones that said we're wrong. No, shale gas footprint isn't as bad as coal. And that's true if you take the 100-year time frame, low estimates of methane from shale gas, high from coal, and the low global warming potential. The major driver on this, quite frankly, is the time frame, not the assumptions about the methane leakage. The other studies all say no, shale gas is worse than coal on time frames of at least up to 50 years. And again, that is a very robust conclusion. You'd also get the same conclusion from the other studies there if you looked at the less than 50-year time period. So I think we have a pretty robust result. Let me skip through that pretty quickly because it's from the Department of Energy, EIA, and I was already suspicious of it before sitting through all the presentations this morning, and so I don't want to even try to defend it, and I'm not really using it. I do want to say, though, that the major projection is that shale gas, if it's developed the way that energy industry and government believe, is not likely to be a huge increase in the amount of natural gas in the country, and it's thought to largely replace conventional gas and conventional uses of conventional gas. And that means that the greenhouse gas footprint will go up because you're taking conventional gas, which has lower methane emissions, and substituting in shale gas. And the shale gas emissions are 50 to 60% higher, according to either us or the EPA, and therefore the greenhouse gas emissions will go up. Now, can emissions be reduced there's a lot of interest in that, and I'd be really happy to take questions and talk about later. Let me just very quickly say yes. Clearly, the sort of emissions we talked about can be reduced, but it's not all accidental leakage. A lot of this is purposeful venting. It's part of the design plan of how the industry operates, and that's based on their current sense of economics. So going to my third point down there, economics alone is not likely to drive a reduction in that. It would require very strong regulation if we're going to do it. Certainly a lot could be done at wellhead to reduce leakages. A lot of technology exists. We're left with the problem of leakages in storage systems and in pipelines. And again, these are old systems. It would be extremely expensive to replace the pipeline infrastructure of the United States. And it might make sense if we're looking at natural gas as a long-term solution, but if we're viewing it as a bridge fuel over several decades, it may not make economic sense. Just to put the economics in context, to give you some sense of what industry may or may not be willing to do in terms of reducing these emissions, this shows the price of natural gas from 1975 up until a few months ago, and it peaked a few years ago, which is when industry got really excited about shale gas. It's gone back down. I've got two lines on there. One is what the International Energy Administration announced last week in Paris is the break-even point for the U.S. industry. It's about $6.17 per 1,000 cubic feet. If the price of gas is less than that, they say industry's losing money. And the other is some estimates from Art Berman, who puts it higher. Either way, you can see that industry's not making a lot of money at the moment, and that, of course, is going to make them resistant to putting in environmental control generally or methane controls in particular. So let me finish with one point, just a few slides. How am I doing on time? Okay. Okay, give me 2 minutes.
Sure.
I mentioned that our numbers compare pretty favorably with the new EPA numbers for emission estimates, and I've said that several times. So I want to give you a little bit of context with that and then move you towards what that looks for the United States as a whole. Back in 1996, the EPA, working with industry, came up with a series of emission factors for methane from the natural gas and oil industries. And up until this past year, that is what the EPA has used and what the IPCC has used globally for estimating what the role of the natural gas industry is in methane emissions. EPA completely redid their analysis and released some preliminary stuff on that 11 months ago, and they've since then put out 3 or 4 reports, and they're continuing to update it. They've increased the emission factors in many parts of the oil and gas industry substantially in terms of methane leakage. So what does that mean? I just want to show you, this is what the total U.S. greenhouse gas inventory looks like for the base year of 2008, and I'm picking that just because it's the last year where I can compare old and new EPA numbers. On the left is what the EPA would have been saying a year ago were the emissions for 2008, and the numbers on the right are what they say for the same base year they now are with the new emission numbers. So the total greenhouse gas emissions of the United States have gone up. That's because of a change in the methane numbers. The methane emissions have gone up, and the methane from natural gas has gone up. So you can see here that we would now say 3.5% of the total greenhouse gas footprint of the United States comes from methane leakage from the natural gas industry. That doesn't sound like a huge amount, but they're using a global warming potential of 21, based on what the IPCC said back in 1996. That's a 100-year time frame and a really old number. I asked them why they did that, and they said, for political reasons, we were told to use that number. That's what Kyoto Protocol said, we're going to use it. Okay, the new number, if you want to use a shorter time frame, would be 105 instead of 21. So let me just show you what that does. On the left axis is the greenhouse gas emissions. Total emissions is the top line. The second one is the methane emissions, and they run parallel. And on the bottom is what we assume for the global warming potential for methane, starting on the left with a factor of 21, which is what the EPA is using, and going way over to 105, which is the most recent and best number for the shorter time frame of 20 years. The point is that if you take the 100-year time frame and use an old analysis, methane is not that big of a story. But if you take the short time frame, which I think you have to if you're serious about this tipping point, and we use the most recent science, then methane is making up 44% of the entire greenhouse gas footprint of the United States, and the single largest source of that is the natural gas industry. So I think we need to pay attention to that. Thank you very much, and again, I'm really pleased to be part of this today.
That was Dr. Robert Howarth of Cornell, co-author of the peer-reviewed paper Methane and the Greenhouse Gas Footprint of Natural Gas from Shale Formations. My thanks to the Association for the Study of Peak Oil and Gas, USA, for this presentation, and to Carl Etnier from Equal Time Radio on WDEV Waterbury, Vermont, for the recording. And thank you to Radio EcoShock DC correspondent Jerry Williams.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Now we'll speak directly with Robert Howarth about his work and the startling conclusion that methane may contribute almost half of all human-made greenhouse gas emissions in the United States. How do we know? And what can we do about it? Let's find out.
Because it's hard to contain all the methane released. It can get into the air, it can get into the streams. It's a greenhouse gas worse than CO2. Fracking done wrong, things of climate change too.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, here with Robert W. Howarth, the David R. Atkinson Professor of Ecology and Environmental Biology at Cornell University. Dr. Howarth, along with the engineering professor Tony Ingrafia and René Santoro, a research technician, analyzed data from published sources, industry reports, and presentations by the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA. It was all to calculate the total greenhouse emissions from hydraulic fracturing of shale gas. Many know it as gas fracking. Their peer-reviewed paper was published in May 2011 in the journal Climatic Change Letters. Bob Howarth, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Bob, you've taken a lot of heat for this paper. Did you expect this much pushback, and have you found some support as well?
We've been surprised by the level of pushback, to be honest. In the 6 months since our paper was published, there have been an incredible amount of attacks on the blogosphere, but there have also been several new peer-reviewed papers and some reports that have come out since then. A few of those reports, two or three of them, support our findings, and others are critical of our findings. But you know, we're pretty confident in what we've said, and so far I've seen nothing to really make me change my mind.
You answered critics in a November speech in Washington, D.C. at the American Association for the Study of Peak Oil, known as ASPO. And if you'll permit an amateur observation from me, my take is this. Some people didn't want you to write about fracking emissions at all. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that's an astute observation. You know, the industry and to some extent government as well have been promoting this shale gas as an energy panacea. So, win-win of almost infinite fossil fuels that we can use without really kicking our fossil fuel addiction and yet emit fewer greenhouse gases. Now, the science basis for that assumption that shale gas had a low greenhouse gas footprint just was not there. Our study was the very, very first analysis in the scientific literature, and we reached an opposite conclusion. So apparently a lot of people just prefer to base policy on assumptions as opposed to good data, and they're not happy with what we pulled together.
I was surprised to learn the industry routinely vents methane, a potent greenhouse gas, into the air as part of their normal course of business. Why don't they capture this gas and sell it instead?
Well, that's a good question. Some of the venting they do is simply when they develop a new well, they don't have a pipeline available to connect the new source and get it to market, or if they're developing gas that's associated with oil, it may just not be as valuable as the oil in many cases, and so they'll vent the gas. But there's also, even when they have a pipeline available, they appear to be venting a huge amount of gas. At the time of well completion from one of these shale gas wells, after that frac fluid starts to come back up, there's about a two-week period, and the best evidence is that they're venting large amounts of methane at that point in time. They could collect it and send it to market. They could also flare it, that is, burn it, which would be better from a greenhouse gas standpoint. But the U.S. EPA, who's looked closely at this, estimates that 85% of the time they're neither flaring nor putting it to market. They are simply venting it to the atmosphere. As to why they're not marketing it instead, the EPA estimates that actually if they were to put the equipment in place to capture that initial gas and take it to market, they would turn a profit, but it's a small profit, a very small profit, and the rate of return just is not as up to what the gas industry is used to, so they prefer to use their capital to develop new wells faster instead and simply vent off the gas.
Bob, in your speech at ASPO, you explained a key chart which our radio listeners aren't able to see, of course. Can you give us the highlights from that series of bars in a chart titled Comparison of Greenhouse Gas Emissions from Shale Gas with Low and High Estimates of Fugitive Methane Emissions?
What that shows, we've analyzed the greenhouse gas footprint of shale gas at two time frames, a shorter time frame over a couple of decades following gas emission and a longer one at a 100-year time frame after emission. And particularly at the shorter time frame, methane is a very large component of the greenhouse gas footprint of shale gas or natural gas in general. Natural gas is mostly methane, and methane is such an incredibly powerful greenhouse gas that you really need to consider its role and not just the carbon dioxide that's burned and released at the time of burning the fuel. So at the shorter time frame, a 20-year integrated time frame after methane's emitted to the atmosphere, the radiative forcing of methane is more than 100 times greater than that of carbon dioxide. And that means that at that shorter time frame, the largest single component of the greenhouse gas footprint of shale gas is the methane leakage and the methane venting. Now, there's some methane venting from coal as well and from oil, but it's a much smaller component of those. And so when we include the methane as part of the greenhouse gas analysis, we conclude, particularly at this shorter time frame, that shale gas actually has the largest greenhouse gas footprint of any fossil fuel out there, far larger than oil, larger than conventional natural gas, and larger than coal as well.
You mentioned Dr. Drew Schindel's new work. Can you tell us who Schindel is and what he is saying that has an impact on this subject?
We used Schindel's work heavily in our analysis. Schindel and colleagues published a paper in the Journal of Science back in 2009 where they reassessed what we call the global warming potential of methane relative to carbon dioxide. Prior to that, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, had been saying that at the 100-year time frame, methane was about 72-fold more powerful of a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. Schindel looked at how methane interacts with other radiatively active materials in the atmosphere and concluded that it's more potent in its influence on global warming relative to carbon dioxide, specifically about 105-fold more. That study has held up very well to scrutiny. Schindel and his colleagues are at the NASA Goddard Space Institute. And in fact, Schindel is the lead author on this whole topic of global warming potentials for the next go-around of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. So we use their analysis. We've been criticized for that. Some people say you should use the older, lower numbers. In fact, the U.S. EPA continues to use 15-year-old numbers, which are a good deal smaller. But we think you should use the best, most recent science.
Well, speaking of scientists at NASA, Dr. James Hansen also wrote an important paper on methane in October 2006, and I just want to make a note to listeners. You can find my review of that in the Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info for this week. I've got a methane primer and kind of a review of what James Hansen said at the time. Why is that James Hansen paper important?
Well, it's a very important paper that Hansen and colleagues wrote. They pointed out that if you don't control methane, the Earth is really in some trouble. And there's another analysis the United Nations just came out with this summer, which really builds on that and puts some newer numbers on it as well. If you look at the Hansen paper and the United Nations report together, what they tell you is that if we do not control methane and only try to control carbon dioxide emissions, we could reach a dangerous tipping point in the climate system as soon as 15 years from now, more likely 30 years from now, but relatively near term. That tipping point might be something like melting of the permafrost in the Arctic regions, which would put natural sources of methane into the atmosphere and result in sort of a positive runaway global warming. So Hansen did a very compelling job of laying out the basis for that. He said the critical tipping point is 1.8 degrees above the historical baseline for global mean temperature. And what the United Nations shows is that we're very likely to reach that tipping point without immediate effort to control methane. That's part of the reason I think shale gas is such a poor energy bridge. It's likely to aggravate the methane releases as opposed to controlling them.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Dr. Robert Howarth from Cornell University. He upset the golden goose of shale gas fracking, saying, as you've just heard, it's not a solution to avert climate change. Specific to the shale gas industry, Bob, what research do we need? What do we need to know more about?
Well, there's several aspects we should be paying closer attention to. You know, our paper, which came out last April, used the best available data on what the methane emissions, both venting and leakage, are. But as we said in the paper, the quality of the data and the documentation behind the data are in many cases poor. So we need better information on what those fluxes are. We need a better sense of how much those might be able to be reduced. Unfortunately, the industry has taken sort of a head-in-the-sand approach to this. So the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has, in fact, proposed regulations which would require industry to provide better data on what the emissions are, and the American Natural Gas Association and Chesapeake Gas Corp, which is the largest developer of shale gas, have gone to court to try to prevent them being compelled to provide that information. So having industry comply with reporting requirements would be extremely helpful. Beyond that, we really need some independent verification of these numbers. And I don't think society wants to be in the position of relying just on industry for the source of such important information.
Bob Howarth, some of your critics complain that you, a mere professor of ecology and biology at Cornell University, dare to examine emissions from this bonanza of shale gas fracking. Yet before your paper in Climatic Change Letters, neither the government nor the industry was undertaking a comprehensive review of the problem. Bob, if they don't want you to do the studies, who should do it?
There's an aspect of the industry that just doesn't want information out there, and I'm afraid that pertains to government as well. This win-win thought that shale gas would allow an easy way forward with energy policy without having to make hard choices on things like conservation and using energy more efficiently is just too attractive for some politicians. So I think they just really don't want objective information. I mean, it's comparable to what our society and government has done in developing ethanol from corn, which all of the best science information would suggest probably aggravates global warming as opposed to helps it, and we now use some 40% of the corn of the United States to produce ethanol, producing pretty small amounts of energy, less than 1% of our total energy use in the United States, and yet a massive disruption to the global food market.
Is there a standard measurement of methane in the global atmosphere like the Mauna Loa reports on carbon dioxide? And if so, are the gross amounts of methane on the rise?
Yes, the average methane in the atmosphere back when I was a graduate student in the 1970s was about 1.4 parts per million. That's been rising pretty steadily from the 1970s up until late 1990s. And in the 1990s, it actually leveled off and was, it didn't go down, but the concentration was steady for a number of years, which gave some hope that perhaps we'd gotten things under control. In retrospect, that seems to have been associated with the collapse of the natural gas industry in the former Soviet Union. And over the last half dozen years or so, again, the methane concentrations are once more on the rise. Exactly what's driving that is not as well known as it should be. There are a lot of sources of methane to the atmosphere, both natural and human-controlled, and a lot of sinks for methane as well. And we have an imperfect understanding of how those all fit together.
At the end of your speech at ASPO USA in Washington, D.C., you suggested methane could account for as much as 44% of the entire greenhouse gas emissions of the United States. Now, you were hurried due to time limitations. Could you expand on that?
Absolutely. I'd be delighted to expand on that. The EPA, within the last year, and particularly last spring, about the same time as our paper came out, has started to reanalyze the greenhouse gas inventory for the entire United States, all sources of greenhouse gas emissions. And in doing so, they've increased their estimate for how much methane is coming from the natural gas industry. They now say it's close to 40% or so of all of the human-controlled methane emissions are coming from natural gas. Fair amount of that is coming from shale gas in their estimation. They still underestimate the importance of methane, though, because they're using this global warming potential, the comparison of methane to carbon dioxide. They're using a a value that came out of the early 1990s. It's low. It's about 21-fold larger for methane than for carbon dioxide. It's based on the 100-year time frame, and it's a low number even for that time frame. If you were to instead take the 20-year time frame and use the latest information from Schindel and colleagues on what the global warming potential for methane is, then you'd scale up their methane compared to carbon dioxide. And that's how I reached the conclusion that it would be about 45% of the total greenhouse gas emissions for the entire United States are coming from this methane. And again, the natural gas industry would be the major part of that.
Dr. Howarth, surely you must have thought about the big picture impacts of your paper. Millions of us heat with gas, millions more drive with it, whole industries count on it. If gas is little better than coal, what should we do about all the proposed new drilling, not just in the United States, but it's happening in Canada and the UK and all over the world? What do we do now?
Well, my take is that we should put a moratorium on this, at least until we have a better understanding of the environmental consequences, both the global warming consequences and the water quality aspects, which I think are also quite severe. Are there alternatives to simply developing more of this natural gas? And absolutely. You know, most of the natural gas, both globally and in the United States, is used for heating. It's used to heat water. It's used to heat space in homes and commercial buildings. And there's the lowest hanging fruit for energy policy is better insulating homes, using energy for heating more efficiently. We just, as a society, don't pay enough attention to how easy it would be to use less energy for heating. So I think if we moved aggressively towards energy conservation, particularly in the home heating market, that we could more than offset the natural gas we might get from shale, and it would be at far better consequences for the environment and probably create more jobs as well.
What made you look into the full impact of gas fracking?
I actually knew very little about hydraulic fracturing until just a couple of years ago. I was on sabbatical leave at the University of Paris back in the spring of 2009 and started to hear rumors about an expanded hydraulic fracturing for gas. It's a new technology. It's been used in Texas for the last 10, 12 years. Outside of Texas, significant shale gas development has occurred only in the last 3 to 4 years, so it's a new technology. When I came back from sabbatical, there was a proposal to increase shale gas development in New York State and Pennsylvania, started to have some development. And it was being widely advertised on TV as this energy future that's good for global warming. That just didn't ring true. I, for the previous few years, had been chair of the International Council of Sciences Committee on Biofuels and the Environment. We'd looked very carefully at the greenhouse gas footprint associated with biofuels. And I knew there's a lot of complexity there, which perhaps wasn't reflected in the advertisement. So I looked forward, the scientific literature which would deal with the greenhouse gas emissions from shale, and I found there's absolutely nothing there. So with some courage, we decided to step into the vacuum and take it on as a research challenge. And we spent about 2 years searching for information and running draft ideas by colleagues and by expert critics, and that finally culminated in that paper last April.
Bob Howarth, what is next for you? What are you working on now?
Well, we're doing a few things. I mean, at the moment, we're writing a summary of all of the papers and reports that have come out since our paper 6 months ago. Beyond that, we're looking more carefully at the global trends in methane and what the role of the oil and gas industry may be in those. We're looking more directly at the greenhouse gas inventory for the United States and how that might be able to be reduced through alternative energy policies.
You have been listening to Robert Howarth, the Cornell University scientist who investigated the real story of dangerous methane emissions from the shale gas industry. Find links to his work, his speech at ASPO, and an MP3 of this interview in the Radio EcoShock blog dated November 23, 2011, at ecoshock.info. Bob, thank you so much for starting this whole conversation.
Thank you for your interest. I'm very pleased to be able to talk with you today.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
Everything you read in the mainstream media is 100% true. Please, go back to your jobs. If you have not got a job, you are a worthless human being. Consume, consume, consume until we have no planet left to consume. That's the best way to support the economy.
Carbon trading schemes have been the darlings of governments, banks, and Wall Street traders. They say, let the free market solve climate change. But the system has been abused in many ways. Here is my conversation with famed biologist Samuel Labuddy of the International Investigation Agency. Production of the world's most powerful global warming gas is being ramped up to collect fake carbon credits, say environmental investigators. As the World Bank has handed out billions of dollars to suspect companies in China and India, we go to Samuel Labuddy, a famous wildlife biologist in Washington, D.C., now covering the atmosphere beat for the Environmental Investigation Agency. Samuel, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
Sam, I'd like to make the most of our limited time. Please explain what HFC-23 is and the risks to our atmosphere.
Well, HFCs are also known as hydrofluorocarbons, and that doesn't mean much except that they're one of the six greenhouse gases, along with CO2, methane, nitrous oxide, and a couple others. HFCs are the replacement compounds for the chemicals that formerly were destroying the ozone, that are still destroying the ozone layer, the things in our refrigerators and air conditioners used in foam blowing, applications like that. And you wouldn't think that our collective refrigerators and air conditioners could have such a huge impact on climate, but bear in mind that our refrigerators and air conditioners were what punched a continent-sized hole in the ozone layer that we're still working very hard to try and repair. So these hydrofluorocarbons, HFCs, they're the replacements for ozone-depleted chemicals, and they are, even though they're compared to other greenhouse gases, there really is no comparison. They are what we call super greenhouse gases. They have an ability to trap light energy and convert it to heat, like CO2 does, except they are hundreds to thousands of times more powerful than CO2 as warming agents, and so they're a big problem.
Do they also damage the ozone layer?
They do not. That's why they were chosen as substitutes for the compounds containing chlorine, which do attack and destroy ozone. And among these HFCs, HFC-23 is the most powerful one. In fact, it is the second most powerful greenhouse gas known to science. It's 15,000 times more powerful than CO2 as a warming agent. The odd thing about HFC-23, however, is it's not even produced intentionally for any use. It's a byproduct of a ozone-depleting substance that's still being manufactured largely in overseas and developing countries that haven't quite caught up to the Western world, per se, in terms of phasing out their ozone-depleting substances. A lot of it's just vented directly into the atmosphere, where it plays havoc with climate.
So if I understand this correctly, about half of the carbon credits to date are allegedly to prevent the production of a gas, which could easily and cheaply have been solved years ago. Is that correct?
The HFC-23 is a waste gas. It's a byproduct of a production of an ozone-depleting substance that's supposed to be being phased out under the Montreal Protocol. The problem is that in the international world of carbon credits, or offsets as they're called, the United Nations and the Kyoto Protocol are actually paying developing countries to capture and destroy this waste gas in the routine manufacture of the refrigeration compound that they're still manufacturing. The problem is they pay them so much for the destruction of this waste gas that oftentimes the carbon credits that they get from capturing and destroying it are worth more than their principal product that they're producing. So this has created what we call a perverse incentive. Because countries like China and India are receiving so much money to destroy this byproduct, this waste gas, they actually intentionally produce more of it so they can get paid more. So basically a lot of the carbon credits that have been issued under the Kyoto Protocol, estimates are as much as a quarter to a third of all the carbon offsets ever issued under Kyoto, are basically frauds. They didn't offset anything, in spite of the fact that they cost about $2 billion to buy. And these offsets are supposed to be the world's first line of defense against global warming. This is how we're supposed to be encouraging developing countries and stimulating countries in the European Union and Japan and other Kyoto signatories to limit their own emissions so that they don't have to buy these offsets.
Well, just recently, the Environmental Investigation Agency suggested China may be engaged in a kind of global warming blackmail. Can you tell us about that?
Well, this waste gas, all the facilities that manufacture or that produce this HFC-23 waste gas in Europe, Japan, the United States, voluntarily capture and destroy the HFC-23 as part of the cost of doing business, as part of responsible industry practice, if you will. And developing countries, because Kyoto has paid them so much to destroy this waste gas, they basically created an industry for producing this. And recently, the European Union, the 27 nations over there, decided that these credits were not good. They weren't good for carbon markets. They weren't doing a lot to slow down or reverse global warming. And they passed legislation where they're going to basically ban the use of these credits in their carbon market beginning in 2013. And that is the world's biggest carbon market. And China has decided that, or is threatening that if they're not going to be paid to capture and destroy this waste gas and eliminate its powerful impact on global warming, that they're simply going to vent it into the atmosphere. This despite the fact that China alone has been paid somewhere in the neighborhood of $1 billion to capture and destroy this waste gas, enough money to basically pay for the destruction of this waste gas for decades to come, well past the time at which it's supposed to be phased out completely. And so this basically amounts to blackmail. They're saying, if you won't pay us ridiculous, absurd amounts of money to destroy something that we should be destroying anyway, just of our own accord, then we're going to vent it into the atmosphere, and the world will have hell to pay for it.
Yeah, and it lasts 250 years. Well, Samuel Labuddy, we've known about this loophole for years, but at the end of 2011, we were still going to the Durban Climate Conference trying to seal it up. What needs to happen there?
A lot of things need to happen in Durban. With respect to this particular issue, I think some of the parties need to make it clear, basically the Kyoto signatories that pay for carbon offsets, that they need to tell the Chinese and the Indian governments very clearly that these credits have no place in the future of carbon markets, and that when the current contracts expire for HFC-23 destruction, that that's it. At that point, China and India and everybody else that's manufacturing or that's generating this waste gas, they need to take responsibility for the costs of capturing it and destroying it themselves. The nations of the world need to let China and India know that this gravy train, if you will, that has basically subsidized an industry that's supposed to be being phased out, is done. One thing they cannot do is indulge this type of greed going forward if we're actually going to be responsive to addressing climate change.
Do they need to pass a new law? Do they have to just come up with a signed agreement with the countries? What actually will be the mechanism that ends this whole facade?
That's a good question. There are a number of problems with the offset market. This is clearly the largest one. More so than an agreement being signed, I think it's just a matter of a political reality becoming clear so that the governments like China and India can become more realistic about what they can expect in the future going forward and what they have to contribute to a global climate agreement if indeed we are going to be effective in combating global warming.
Well, I would say if we're going to survive. Can you please give us your organization website for those who want to follow up?
Yes. In the United States, it's eia-global.org. I mean, we have a number of reports about our different campaigns, not just on climate and atmosphere, but also on illegal wildlife trade and illegal logging as well.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is the award-winning scientist Samuel Labuddy from the Environmental Investigation Agency. Thank you for helping us out today.
Thank you.
During this program, you heard clips from the song My Water's on Fire Tonight, written and performed by David Holmes, Andrew Bean, and Neil Becker. That's from the Australian anti-fracking album, Whole Lot of Fracking Going On, at wholelotoffrackinggoingon.com. The song is based on ProPublica's investigation on hydraulic fractured gas drilling. Find links to their whole investigative report and to the song video in my Radio EcoShock blog for November 23rd, 2011 at ecoshock.info. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .info. You can download today's program and all of our past programs at our website, ecoshock.org. I am Alex Smith. Thank you for listening, and tune in again next week for more Radio EcoShock.